This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine, information at doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you're a registered New Hampshire voter and you have a phone, you have definitely heard from them, the pollsters, those insistent, frequent callers trying to determine how you'll vote in the midterm election. Perhaps you're happy to oblige. Many voters watch for the pre-election day polls, after all. Many others are sick of those calls by now and have stopped picking up for numbers that they don't recognize. To those people, and there are many, polling the pollsters may sound like a form of revenge. But that is what polling aggregation website 538 Blog, created by Nate Silver, is doing. Carl Bialik is 538's lead writer for news and author of a series of articles of data gathered from those who gather data. Carl, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks very much for having me.
So just a little review quickly on how polling works. Who does them and how?
That answer is changing all the time, but the basic answer is that professionals are doing them because they're being paid by a newspaper or by a campaign, and they hire people to call up the people like your listeners in their homes, perhaps more than they'd like to be called, and ask them questions that have been decided on in advance to get a sense of who they're going to vote for, why, what they care about, what they don't care about.
With many newspapers pulling back on coverage and beats altogether, are there fewer pollers than there used to be?
There are fewer who are doing the most expensive form, which is the kind I described, but there are many who are trying other methods. Some of your listeners may have gotten calls that sound like they're from a live person but are a recording, and that's a less expensive way to poll. Some pollsters are trying out online panels, which can be expensive to set up, but then once you have the panel, it's very cheap to do a poll of them.
It's hard to believe, however, in the age of cell phones and caller ID that people would be bothered to answer a poll. Did pollsters indicate that they're having a harder time just reaching people to answer their questions?
Absolutely. The phone pollsters are seeing response rates declining every year, and this has been a long-term trend. So by now, their response rates don't have much farther to decline. Some of the pollsters are telling us that fewer than 5% of the calls eventually yield a completed interview. So it's really a smaller and smaller group of people who are standing in for everybody else. Hmm. This may not mean that pollsters are out of the game of calling people up completely, but many of them are already thinking of new ways to figure out what public opinion is.
You asked the pollsters about polling errors in the 2014 election, especially Senate election polls. Many cited concern over increases in errors. Why do you think?
I think they're pretty confident that there's not going to be an enormous mistake. There's not going to be headlines saying Dewey beats Truman proven wrong. But they do see, on average, likelihood for higher error this year. Some of the races that are the most interesting, the most closely contested, are in states where they don't have a lot of experience, and where the pollsters who do have a lot of experience maybe don't have the same pedigree. And also, because of the declining budgets of traditional news organizations that have sponsored them, as you mentioned before, there's just fewer polls out there, and sparser polling makes it harder to get the results right, especially if there are fewer polls right before the election when it's kind of easier to get the result.
And in your attempt to get the results right, you did give pollsters you surveyed the option of anonymity. How do you think that might get better results?
Well, I think that some of them have some critical words for their rivals and for the industry in general, but they also have relationships and sometimes refer business to others, depending on the location. And like with any kind of touchy subject matter, anonymity can make people a little freer to talk. Now, that has trade-offs because we prefer to know who's saying what to us and to our readers. But I think, as it is, trying to get them to make time to respond to our questions just before Election Day is tough. So I figured I would give them a chance to decide. And it's interesting because they get to decide on each question, and it really depends on the question. Some people really change their minds on whether they want to be quoted or not from question to question.
Your most recent poll of pollsters focused on ethics. Now, earlier this year, one of your colleagues reported on evidence that suggested that some pollsters were copying the results of others in order to make sure that the numbers fell in line with their peers. What was the response from the pollsters when you asked about whether or not they do this?
Everyone said they didn't.
Of course. They would.
They would. So that wasn't very surprising. One of them who, funny enough, asked for anonymity said, "Do you really think anyone's going to answer this honestly?" And I think some of them answered honestly, maybe most of them, maybe all of them, because I think it's certainly not something that every pollster does. But we also asked them if they thought that their peers are doing this. And of the ones who answered, more than half said they think they are. Now, we didn't get any smoking guns or hard evidence, but if many of them think it's happening, that's more reason for us to think it's happening.
Now, when asked who the pollsters predicted would win the Senate, the response was 2/3 believe the Republicans will have the majority. Does this jibe with your own simulations at 538?
Well, we find that somewhere between 3/5 and 2/3 of the time when we run simulations that the Republicans are going to hold the Senate. And that's been a very steady figure. It shows that the pollsters are either looking at our numbers or some of our competitors' numbers and seeing the same thing, that this looks like it'll probably be a Republican takeover of the Senate, but not by much of a margin.
Carl, I have to ask in closing, do you call them all at dinner time?
We're using the internet. So we're one of those experimenters with the new method. Figure in this case, since we're not randomly dialing people, we know who we're reaching, the internet's just as good. And, that way they don't have to deal with people mispronouncing words or the tone of their voice influencing answers. And maybe they'll feel a little more comfortable giving honest answers to a machine than to a person.
Well, Carl, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Carl Bialik is 538's lead writer for news, and you'll find a link to his articles, several of them about polling pollsters. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. There was a time when Playboy was considered a serious magazine for political journalism and a yardstick of American taste. And then, of course, there were the centerfolds. When we come back, we'll hear about how a group of former Playboy models, now in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, remember their moment and their month. That's when Word of Mouth continues, after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. For a magazine that spends most of its life covered by a brown wrapper or tucked under a bed, Playboy magazine is an icon, even if you read it only for the articles. In December of 1953, a young Hugh Hefner put a fully clothed Marilyn Monroe on the cover, smiling brightly and giving the camera a wave. For 50 cents, readers could see in full color the blonde bombshell nude. Playboy would go on to crown over 600 playmates and counting. In an article for New York Magazine, senior editor Noreen Malone takes a look back with a few centerfolds from the early days of Playboy magazine. Noreen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So what was Playboy like in 1953?
It was brand new to the scene. Hugh Hefner was trying to create a sort of hip lifestyle more than anything. He really did have a lot of good writers who were contributing. So people who said they read Playboy just for the articles, you know, they had a leg to stand on. But it was a different kind of standard of female beauty than you might see in Playboy today. It was gentler. It was more associated with sort of the pinups of earlier eras.
So it was the up-and-comer. How was Playboy choosing its centerfolds back then?
Well, in the case of one of the women I interviewed for this article, her name is Dolores Del Monte, and she was one of the very first Playboy centerfolds. She had a few years earlier done a bit of nude modeling for what she thought was just going to be a pinup calendar. And Playboy bought the rights to that pinup calendar from a company in Chicago. And Dolores got a phone call, and someone asked her, you know, can we use one of your old photographs in a magazine? She had no idea what Playboy was. It didn't even register for her. It was so new. She didn't even realize that it was one of her nude photographs. In fact, it was the only nude photograph she'd taken. She thought it was a swimsuit picture. And she didn't find out until years later that she had been in Playboy, which by then was an icon of America.
So I read in your article that Dolores made about $50 for an hour of work at that point. It came back to, I guess, haunt her much later in the form of her son discovering it. What was the story there?
Right. That's a really fun story. It was in the late 70s, and it was Playboy's 25th anniversary edition, I believe. And they had a special issue of the magazine with tiny little versions of each of the centerfolds. And her son, who was then in college, had bought an issue of Playboy, and he was perusing the historical centerfolds. And he remembered that his mother had done some modeling under the name Dolores Del Monte. She had never told him that it was nude modeling. And so he saw one of the centerfolds was labeled Dolores Del Monte, and he immediately sort of slammed it shut. And he called his mother and said, "Mom, I've got some news about your past." And she was, you know, I think she was a little embarrassed because her son had seen it. But ultimately, Dolores was very proud of the photographs. She has them hanging in her house now. You know, she attended her first party at the Playboy Mansion in 1997. She's really embraced it.
Well, a number of the women that you spoke to seem to embrace it. In fact, many of them pose, again, not necessarily nude for New York Magazine. But in general, was there a sense of, I don't know, victimization here or something else?
No, absolutely not. I think we tend to think oftentimes that, you know, women who are modeling in various states of undress are being objectified and that they are, you know, somehow being taken advantage of. But at least for all of these women, they felt very much in control of the situation. They'd made the decision themselves to pose. They felt that Playboy treated them with the utmost respect. They also were making what was very good money for the time. They many of them worked in the Playboy bunny clubs, and they really got to see the world. Several of the women I spoke to said, you know, Playboy opened so many doors for me. It put me in this world that I wouldn't have been able to be in otherwise. So They had a really positive relationship to their time posing.
Another one of the women you spoke to was Marilyn Cole Lowndes. Playboy published its first full frontal nude in 1972, and Marilyn was the model. What does she think of that photograph now?
She's very proud of it. She, you know, at the time, she was a little nervous because it was the very first. And she showed her mother and her father, and her father said, "It looks like a Rubens painting," which was sort of a lovely way for a father to react. And what she says is that it feels sort of timeless, and this is what many of the women say, that the photographs felt artistic to them and they look timeless. And it is true that, you know, nude women have been a staple of fine art, you know, since basically the beginning of humans putting pen to paper.
And they do look relatively tame now, I suppose, even from what we might see on a magazine cover.
Right. So these women all pose, who we photographed in New York Magazine, they all pose in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And in the 70s, and then even more so in the 80s and 90s, Playboy really had to compete with magazines like Hustler and Penthouse, which put much, much more explicit photographs in there. So Playboy began doing full frontal nudity and began showing pubic hair, which it hadn't done before. And also the sort of aesthetic of Playboy shifted. You know, a lot of these women said the women now are so worked out, they're so plastic looking, everyone is tan and blonde. And that's a criticism that people frequently make of sort of later era Playboy, when Playboy had to compete not with just with Penthouse and with Hustler, but also, frankly, with like the plethora of images of nude women online and in online porn that was just much more readily available.
In the article, you bring up the nude selfie, which has become pretty commonplace in a society where cameras are in everyone's pockets and, you know, anyone can have their own boudoir photo shoot if they would like to. Even Hollywood stars, as we find. Now, you say this is about control. And what do you mean by that?
Well, it's kind of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, you don't need, you know, you don't need someone to annoy you and say you're beautiful enough to be, you know, objectified. Women can sort of look at themselves and say, "I am beautiful. I would like to record myself as I am right now." However, once you take a photo in 2014, as we've learned with the recent celebrity photo hacking, nothing is truly private anymore. Any image that you put on your phone, someone could recover. So it is about having control and having control taken away from you.
I wonder if seeing these women so many years later, obviously we're getting a much different view of the human body than when they were young, nubile Playboy centerfolds. What did you think of that photo shoot?
One of the things that I loved most about these photos is how much the women all loved it. They were, you know, initially they were nervous. Listeners should check out the photographs. They are posed in various versions of lingerie, and these are women in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and even one woman in her 80s. And at first, of course, they were nervous, and then they just really got into it. And all of the women had what I thought was a really wonderful relationship to their own beauty. Instead of being, you know, sort of sad about what had faded or what had changed, they all sort of said, I'm so much wiser now than I was then. And, you know, they're all beautiful looking older women.
Yeah. No airbrushing going on there. Very unvarnished and lovely.
Yeah.
Well, Noreen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Noreen Malone is senior editor at New York Magazine, and that's where we found her article, The View from a Centerfold. You'll find a link to the article and the photos, which are safe for work, by the way, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, clothes are not a highlight of Playboy photo shoots, but one particular style of shoe has gotten plenty of attention throughout the magazine's 60-year history, the high heel. In this episode of 99% Invisible, Roman Mars and Avery Truffleman investigate the unusual design behind what is often regarded as the most alluring, if undeniably uncomfortable, of shoes.
As a fashion object and symbol, the high heel is weighted with meaning.
It is also weighted with the wearer's entire body weight.
Avery Truffleman doesn't tend to wear heels.
I just cannot do it. The high-heeled shoe might be one of the only designs that is physically painful and somehow persists.
I can't tell when the heel was actually invented.
Elizabeth Semmelhack curates a very specialized museum in Toronto.
I'm Elizabeth Semmelhack, and I'm the senior curator at the Battersea Museum.
High heels are the focus of Elizabeth Semmelhack's research and the subject of her book, Heights of Fashion, A History of the Elevated Shoe.
And that history, as it turns out, started with men.
Many horseback riding cultures wore heels on their boots and on their shoes for riding.
As early as the 10th century, the Persian cavalry was wearing inch-high, high heels.
Heels help you stay in the stirrups, which is why cowboy boots have heels.
And so European men have heels added to their riding boots. It's associated with upper-class practice, because having horses, keeping horses, you know, it's like having a sports car. Within short order, upper-class women added heels to their own outfits.
Then heels started to get gendered in their designs. Men's heels grew broad and sturdy, and women's became tapered and decorative. Finally, men deemed them impractical, and in the 18th century, the high heel is strictly a lady shoe. And then the invention of the camera. With photography came pornography, and with the rise of pornography came the rise of the heel.
Pornography embraced high, thin heels before fashion did, because heels work great when you don't have to move and you're just posing for a few minutes.
The pinups that are in men's barracks during World War II almost always have high heels on them. When the war is over and the men return home, that is when the stiletto is invented, because the stiletto brings fashion into alignment with men's erotica.
As heels made their way out of photography and onto the street, there arose the engineering challenge of trying to make this fundamentally uncomfortable thing comfortable.
I think the physics of putting the weight of a woman's body basically on the balls of her feet is, you know, that's a lot of pressure to try to mitigate.
So people try to find ways around the design. YouTube is full of hacks and tips and tricks.
All you need is felt and a glue stick and some glue.
Foot cushions, these are amazing. They really save your feet.
All you have to do is tape together your third and your fourth toe. I promise this works.
So why bother?
Look, I can't speak for everyone, but when it comes to the appeal of the heel, it's actually not very complex psychology. Heels affect the way you move through the world. They change your walk. They make you push your shoulders back, hold your head up, and swing your hips. They make you taller. But it's not really about that.
People will often say to me, well, women wear high heels today because they want to be as tall as men. I do understand that reasoning, but there are many, many, many men who would equally benefit from increased height. And so why are they ignoring the potential power of the high heel?
But it wasn't too long ago when heels for guys were kind of cool.
Men tried high heels in the 70s, and why didn't it stick?
The men's chunky platform went out of style when power dressing of the 1980s came along. Men were in suits and ties, women were in suits and heels, and they still are.
The high heel could come to mean simply professional power. It could come to be that female professionals are the new power brokers. I would not be surprised if that happens, that men will be as eager to wear high heels as women.
Okay, but only if they can design comfortable ones.
And that piece was produced by Roman Mars and Avery Truffleman for 99% Invisible. Well, the glam continues with a story of the film actress Hedy Lamarr, a renowned movie starlet, remembered for her risque roles, her tumultuous personal life, and of course her contributions to wireless technology. Really, we'll find out more when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Hedy Lamarr was an Austrian-born actress in Hollywood's golden age. She was best known for her arresting beauty and a few risque roles early in her career. Her biggest Hollywood success came in 1949 with the release of Cecil B. DeMille's Samson and Delilah. But Hedy's greatest achievement had nothing to do with the silver screen. Eric Malinsky has more.
Now, would you mind saying that again rather slowly?
I came here to ask you to marry me.
Why?
Because you have no money.
The communications world of technology as we know it, cell phones, GPS, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, it can all be traced back to Hedy Lamarr, the movie actress. I know, it's like saying Rita Hayworth invented the video game. And if this were the story of a movie, it might just seem wacky.
It's not a word I use normally, by the way. It's your word, wacky. It's quite wacky for a film star and a piano player to come up with an idea like that, which is so important in technological terms nowadays.
This is Rob Walters. He wrote a book called Hedy Lamarr and the Mobile Phone. He says the story begins at a Hollywood party in 1940. Hedy Lamarr meets a musician named George Antheil.
They met quite deliberately, although I don't think George knew, so that she could discuss the possibility of enlarging her breasts.
I know this is getting even wackier, but it's true.
Yeah, so he had a bit of a reputation in Hollywood for recommending certain things that could be done to stimulate the glandular system.
Long before the age of silicone implants. Hedy Lamarr talked with him for a while, and then she left the party. He thought that was going to be the end of it, but
when he went out to the car park, she had scrawled her telephone number across his windscreen in lipstick.
Her interest in George wasn't necessarily romantic. She wanted to pick his brain. Okay, a little background on Hedy Lamarr. She'd been married to an arms dealer in Vienna, and even though he was Jewish, he was working for the Nazis. And she was both fascinated by his work because she had the scientific mind and just absolutely disgusted by who he was working for. So naturally, by the time she had gotten to the United States, she really wanted to help the war effort. And she couldn't stop thinking about torpedoes.
Torpedoes, when launched from a ship, normally just take the course that the ship was on. If the ship that they're aiming at, or submarine or whatever, moves out of the way, they can avoid the torpedo. And they were easily traced. They ran off compressed air, so you could see a stream of bubbles behind them.
Now, a ship could conceivably control a torpedo using radio waves. But the problem was always encryption, because the enemy, using a radio, could listen in and, you know, even take control of the torpedo. So this was the idea that Hedy wanted to talk to George about. What if the transmission between the ship and the torpedo was broken into little pieces and then spread across the entire radio spectrum?
The problem is, a very simple problem, how do you make sure that you're exactly in step?
And here's why an experimental composer, like George Antheil, could solve this problem.
George knew how to synchronize pianolas.
He wrote a famous composition called Ballet Mécanique that had 16 automatic pianos playing in sync. So George said, well, what if you put a tiny piano roll inside the torpedo?
And of course, the ship has exactly the same roll as the torpedo.
The holes in the roll determined the frequency that the ship and the torpedo could receive transmissions. They got a professor at Caltech to draw up the patent, and they gave it to the U.S. Navy. And the Navy actually considered it, but the mechanics would have been cumbersome and unreliable.
So they went back to their normal lives of being an actress and a piano player.
Fade to black.
By 1958, the first computer chips are being used.
Retired Colonel David Hughes picks up the story from here.
Contract engineer for the Navy pulled that patent off the shelf and had no idea that it was Hedy Lamarr because it was a U.S. naval patent at this time. And then he used a pair of computer chips which could basically synchronize at both ends. And by 1962, the U.S. Navy then had frequency hopping for secure, classified naval communications. And so that went on for the next 40-some years.
The Navy engineers called it frequency hopping, which always sounded to me like the name of a swing dance. But the official name was CDMA, Code Division Multiple Access. In 1985, CDMA was declassified for commercial use. Now, at that time, the emerging cell phone industry was in the midst of a big fight over which standard to use. And this one electrical engineer named Irwin Jacobs saw the potential of CDMA. He just started a company called Qualcomm, which is now, you know, a cell phone giant. And he spent years trying to convince his colleagues that CDMA had to be the industry standard.
And during that period, there were some professors being quoted from, two in particular from Stanford, that were quoted as saying that CDMA violated the laws of physics, that it would never work.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, you were really just a believer throughout this whole process, long process.
Right. I would wake up at 4 a.m. and, you know, try to think, well, is there some technical point, a marketing point that we're missing that's going to cause this whole thing to stop? But luckily, we managed to bridge all those issues.
Now, when did you find out that Hedy Lamarr was connected to this?
Actually, someone sent us a note about that after we had already started to commercialize CDMA. So I was not aware of it until fairly late in the game.
Now, in the early 90s, Colonel David Hughes was researching the history of frequency hopping. He came across the original patent.
The name of the patent was under Hedwig Keisler.
Well, he knew that Hedwig Keisler was the real name of Hedy Lamarr.
Well, sure, I was in love with her when I was 13 and she was 24.
We truly treated you badly.
Badly and foolishly as well. Your offer is ridiculous.
The invention of Hedy Lamarr and George Antheil evolved into a family of technologies that we call spread spectrum. It's the world we live in today, 3G, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, GPS. And I know this sounds like the end of a movie, and it might be soon. I was tipped off to this story when I met a filmmaker at a party named Amy Redford. She and her colleagues are working on the script of a Hedy Lamarr movie.
And the thing that's wonderful is you go from seeing her sketching out these incredibly complex concepts on cocktail napkins, and then the next thing you know, she's in like a Vegas-style headdress, standing there and not being able to say anything, being told to shut up by a director.
She's an interesting theory about Hedy Lamarr's motivations.
This invention was also her personal redemption. I think she needed to do this. She was, you know, in some ways complicit. She married a guy who was selling arms to the Nazis. And, you know, she comes from a Jewish background. And there's things that she needed to do for her own personal sense of self, as well as for, you know, society and the world at large. In history, so many inventions that were meant to bring people together that ended up being used in war. And this is one that was meant to be applied in war and ended up bringing people together.
I'm Eric Malinsky.
I'm dialing a number for Hedy and George.
Coming up, we'll fast forward to the present and a woman making movies on her own terms. The Oscar-nominated producer of Winter's Bone talks about her new film, Laggies, and the challenge of being a female filmmaker in today's Hollywood. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a break.
Word of Mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 10 years after graduation, Megan has been to grad school, yet still works for her dad's tax office and is still surrounded by her high school friends and boyfriend. She has been floating. So when her boyfriend proposes, she decides it's time for a week-long personal development retreat. But she actually ends up at the home of a high school acquaintance whose father, played by Sam Rockwell, is not having it.
You do realize that reverting to a teenage life and sneaking into my house is weird, correct?
Right.
And why were you trying to sleep over?
The lease on my apartment ran out, and I can't get into my new place for a week. And my friends are... I didn't want to involve them or my parents.
Megan is played by a remarkably unbuttoned Keira Knightley in a new film called Laggies. The film was directed by Lynn Shelton and produced by my guest Alex Madigan. Alex is the Oscar-nominated producer of Winter's Bone and dozens of other films, including White Bird in a Blizzard with Shailene Woodley, that has also just been released. Alex has become a prominent voice for the importance of independent films and filmmakers. We spoke to her when she was in New Hampshire last week to present her film Laggies at Dartmouth. Alex Madigan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me, Virginia.
It is so refreshing to see Keira Knightley in a role that doesn't require her wearing a corset. She is a really big, bankable Hollywood star in an indie movie. How did that happen?
Well, you know, it's really funny with Keira. She's always, I agree with you, a very typecast in, you know, those Pride and Prejudice, even though those movies are usually incredible that she's in and she's wonderful in them, it doesn't really exhibit the great range she has. And a funny story about Keira is that when she was doing, we had a table read of the script 2 days before we started shooting when the talent had flown in. And there was a little bit of an emergency, so I was late in coming to the table read, and I was out of Keira's eye line. I couldn't see her. And I heard someone reading the character of Megan, and I was like, God, who's that person with that really specific Pacific Northwest accent? And I realized at that point it was Keira, and she had such a great ear, not only for an American accent, but a very specific Pacific Northwest one. And she has such a charming, likable, endearing quality, which you really have to have in portraying the character of Megan, because Megan does some pretty unlikable things during the course of that story. I mean, she basically lies the whole time to the people that she's close to. So you have to have an actress who you're going to be able to connect with, and Keira certainly brought that to the table in a wonderful way.
Laggies was directed by Lynn Shelton, who has directed other features and several television episodes. Winter's Bone was also directed by a woman, Deborah Granick, if I'm saying that right.
Yes.
Do you gravitate towards projects made by women?
I've worked with a fair amount of female directors, including Shireen Dabas, who directed a wonderful independent movie called Amrika, and I worked with her recently on a movie that I really loved that was shot in Jordan called Me in the Summer. And I think I do gravitate towards women directors for the reason that I think women like to tell stories about the underdog or the disenfranchised or people who kind of are outside of the group. Like, for some reason, I feel that women are more inclined to tell those kind of stories. And so I love working with women directors, and I feel very fortunate that I've been able to. And Lynn is absolutely remarkable. She really is. The set that she is able to establish in terms of creating a rapport with actors and crew, and I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that she was an actress and she was an editor, that she just has an incredible affinity with working with people across the board. So it was truly a pleasure to come on set every day and work with her.
Well, let's hear another clip from the film Laggies. Here's Megan, now again played by Keira Knightley. She's trying to kind of explain herself to Craig. He's played by Sam Rockwell. He is the father of a high school girl that she's been hanging out with.
After college, I worked some random jobs. Time went by. I'm going to skip to... Okay, I went back to grad school to get my marriage and family therapist degree, because I thought I wanted to have honest conversations with people.
Mm-hmm.
But I did my internship, and I couldn't relate to any of my clients. I felt like a total fraud. So, you know, I kind of found myself in this place, like this kind of weird in-between place, you could say, you know, and I don't know, I was kind of floating.
So that's Keira Knightley playing Megan, kind of, let's say, arrested, you know, a woman not acting her age in the conventional sense anyway. Anyway, age on sets was something that you picked up on in your keynote speech this year at the Sundance Producers Lunch. You were talking about the instability or how to sustain oneself making independent movies. So I'm reading here from a transcript. You're on a film set in upstate New York, and you write, "The crew was bustling and excited, and the activity on set was humming and energized. I looked around, took it all in, and felt like taking a nap. These days, seeing someone on set who is as old as I am is like spotting an elusive antelope. But fortunately, the nice lady doing craft looked to be a contemporary. So I hung out with her, drank a lot of coffee, and got to thinking that maybe this was indeed the opportune moment to pursue my next career choice of animal rescue. But like most of you, I am sure I cannot leave just yet." So where are you now, Alex Madigan? Are you still there, still convinced that making films is better for you than animal rescue?
Well, most days, I think. But it's so funny because I spend a lot of time on sets, you know, when I'm producing a movie, and I do look around me sometimes and I'm like, oh my God, I could be all be your mother. And I do think the hours and the strenuous work aspects, you know, and working on Below the Line and being a part of the crew, it's just, that's something that you really have to do when you're young because it requires so much stamina. And so when you arrive on set and you're a producer and you're of a certain age, it is, you know, it's, you do feel old. It's noticeable, but it's still exciting because you see so many young people who are really still so enthralled in what they're doing and have such great aspirations and are still so inspired by the day-to-day business. They never look at it as a slog, and that's incredibly inspiring to see, I think, in any line of work.
So interesting that you said the maternal instinct, because I was just at the New Orleans Film Festival meeting a person, a young producer, a woman, who proposed that there are more female producers compared to directors, certainly, because there is less ego, there's more managing of personalities, there's this kind of ability to rally people and, you know, trying to keep a lot of people happy, more traditionally female attributes. Do you buy that?
I think it's really funny that you said that because I was just at a premiere of a movie that I worked on that's also opening this Friday called White Bird in a Blizzard with Shailene Woodley, and it's directed by Greg Araki. And I was at the premiere and a man walked up to me and he said, "Oh, congratulations on your movie." And I was so taken aback that he would use that that possessive, you know, the "your." Mm-hmm. And I immediately protested and I said, "Oh, well, it's not my movie." And not indignantly, but just in surprise. And I was standing next to another female independent producer. And she said, "Well, look, a man said that to you," which I thought was really funny because, you know, it is true. I think women never claim ownership of a film in the way that men do. And I do think women have a tendency to be, you know, more collaborative. I think also I was saying, I hope that's not too inflammatory that I just said that, but I think it's also that we have a great ability to multitask. Mm-hmm. And that becomes an incredibly important attribute when you're a producer because you're juggling so many things at once. So to be able to have, you know, a whole lot of stuff going on and lists and be able to do several things at once is of such paramount importance when you're working.
Well, you were nominated for an Oscar as producer of the film Winter's Bone, which catapulted a then 20-year-old Jennifer Lawrence to stardom. Here's a scene from that film.
"What is it you want?"
"I got a real bad need to talk with Thump."
"Now, he ain't got no need to talk to you."
"But I need to. I really, really got to, ma'am, please. Some of our blood at least is the same. Ain't that supposed to mean something? Isn't that what is always said?"
"Ain't you got no men could do this?"
"No, ma'am, I don't."
I'm speaking with the Oscar-nominated film producer Alex Madigan. She is the producer of the film Winter's Bone and has a couple of new films out, Laggy, starring Keira Knightley, and White Bird in a Blizzard, starring Shailene Woodley. So, Alex, you know, what I hear is the rewards are great, but it's such an unsteady business that many people do choose to play it safe, you know, not go the independent route. How do you steel yourself for taking these risks and for surviving the setbacks that are just about inevitable?
I think you always have to be prepared for the no. So when the yes comes, it's such a wonderful and complete surprise. I think the thing that you also hope for is that the no will be quick, because the worst thing that can happen to a project is if there's a long, lengthy period of indecision, whether it's an actor or a financier. So I think you're always hoping that there's movement. And someone said recently, which I thought was such a wise thing, is that when an actor passes on a project, it's always like a sign of a project moving forward, because then you're on to the next person. And I thought that was a wonderful way to look at disappointment. I think it's a business, you know, that has sort of a natural gambler's instinct involved in it. I think you try to stack the odds in your favor, but whether or not a film will succeed is sometimes purely alchemy, too. It's, you know, you can start off with an incredible script and actors and talent, and everything will look great on paper, but for some reason it just won't coalesce in the way that you would want it to, and then sometimes it does in a completely wonderful way. So there's always, no matter how you're facing it, there's always a certain element of surprise involved.
Alex, do you look forward to the day when you are not asked in interviews about being a woman producer in Hollywood?
You know, the thing is that I am a woman producer, and I think that I expect that question, and I never feel that things aren't given to me because I'm a woman. And I know that for female directors, it's a much more difficult road. But I have to say, I will look sometimes around a room. You know, there's a meeting on a project, directors, the writers, the other financiers, the other producers, and I will make the sudden realization that I am the only woman in the room. And that does happen quite a bit.
Well, Alex Madigan, thank you very much for making some time for us today.
Thank you so much, Virginia. Thank you for having me.
Alex Madigan, Dartmouth alum and Oscar-nominated producer. She's got two new films out, Laggies, starring Keira Knightley, Sam Rockwell, and Chloe Grace Moritz, which is now in select theaters, and White Bird in a Blizzard with Shailene Woodley. For more information on the screening at Dartmouth, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org. Well, Friday is Halloween, a day to try on a new personality, admire some adorable kids' costumes, and mostly to have fun. For radio producers, it is an annual excuse to revive the same old Halloween songs again and again and again. We at Word of Mouth are hoping to put aside the Monster Mash and Michael Jackson's Thriller this year, classics though they may be. We're looking for some fresh tracks, so we asked you for some of your favorite underrated Halloween songs on our Facebook page, and you delivered frightfully well. Chris says he put a playlist of unusual Halloween songs together last year. He suggested Dead Man's Party by Oingo Boingo. Walking with the dead man over my shoulder. Tim suggested a cut from one of the strangest bands in New Hampshire history. This is It's Halloween by The Shags.
It's Halloween, it's Halloween, it's time for scares, it's time for screams. It's Halloween, it's Halloween. Why, even Dracula will be there.
Jessica pulled from television's long list of Halloween parody songs. She suggested Tracy Morgan's rendition of Werewolf Bar Mitzvah from the show 30 Rock.
Babe. Werewolf Bar Mitzvah, spooky, scary, boys becoming men, men becoming wolves.
Many of the moodiest Halloween songs have come from horror film soundtracks, like The Exorcist or Halloween. A lesser-known but equally creepy theme was composed for Rosemary's Baby. Here's a cover by the band Fantomas. And while we think this one does get its fair share of playtime every Halloween, we will leave you with a song that received several votes from listeners, Werewolves of London by Warren Zevon. Loads of great stuff to choose from here. So a big thanks to everybody who suggested a spooky tune already. And you can add your suggestion to our growing playlist of underrated Halloween songs. That's on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Virginia Prescott. We will be back with more of the wild, the weird, and the wicked scary on Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio. Well,